even more pleased that it seemed to be working. And I'm very pleased for the opportunity to give this talk. And the title, I'm not sure myself what it will be, but we'll find it down the road. But basically, this, rather than the title, I would just give an idea of what is the subject. The subject is what happens if we have a simple nonlinear ordinary differential equation and we wish to perturb it in a singular fashion. What happens with a different type of solutions of the original unperturbed equation? What sort of deformation will those solutions experience? So let me start with my model example. And by the way, how much time? No, I have 15? 50. Okay. y double prime minus y is equal to y squared. That is a simple model example. And so then I promise to have a singular perturbation. And I would, for example, I will use the differential operator d over dx, where x is the independent variable. So the types of the singular perturbation that I consider, for example, one equation, as you see, this equation is, if we don't have this term, then it will be the original equation. But now it is perturbed by force derivative term. So therefore, it is singular perturbation that the small and epsilon will be, excuse me, considered as a small possible positive parameter. So therefore, it's a singular perturbation. Another type of equation will be a generalized version of this. And I knew that there is a color choke. So, for example, if I found that this perturbation is not rich enough, then I will intend to add the additional terms of, for example, of this nature. So you can see that in the epsilon, as epsilon goes to zero, we again, at least formally, are considering get the same equation. Well, another type of perturbation that might be considered is, for example, this type of perturbation, where this is a finite second symmetrical finite difference operator, right? So in the limit with a step epsilon, so there should be some epsilon here. So when epsilon goes to zero, that again goes to the second derivative. And so on and so forth, but I would like to talk only about some model situations, so I will confine my attention actually only to the first line. Now, so the question, as I said, if we choose some particular solution to this equation or a family of solutions, how would they deform under this or other perturbations? And the question, of course, is where from comes interest for this equation? Well, it or say for n for this perturbation. Actually, it comes if one will consider traveling wave solutions to the singularly perturbed fifth KdV, which is equation of this type, epsilon squared uxxx 1, 2, 3. So that is a KdV up to signs and constants and whatever. This first three terms. We add the fifth order derivative with a small parameter. And then if we are interested in, are there any traveling wave solutions that may survive this perturbation, we will end up with this equation eventually. And the problem then, it will be, is there any solution to this equation that approaches zero at plus and minus infinity? Of course, I'm talking about continuous, smooth, or whatever solutions of this type. Now, of course, it's now time to say a few words about the various types of solutions, or at least two types of solutions of this original equation that I would like to consider. And if we draw the phase portrait of the unperturbed equation, it will look the following way. And so where the axes are y prime and y, and so there will be two stationary points at the origin at the point minus one, I believe, and this is the phase diagram. And of course, if one would like to consider the corresponding potential function or energy, which is given as y prime square minus 2/3 y cube minus y square, then we will have something like this. Right. So this. So now we can clearly interpret. This will be y, and this is this. So we can clearly interpret that this periodic trajectory or periodic orbit inside over here is just a ball that is oscillating in this well, and inside this well. And also there is a separatrix trajectory, which or homoclinic trajectory that originates from this fixed point and ends up also in this fixed point. Actually, we can talk about two branches of this trajectory. One is in the left half plane, and the other is in the right half plane. However, this one in the right half plane goes to infinity, and then somehow returns back, and the same happens over here. Well, my next and again trivial observation is that these two branches of the separatrix, or actually not of separatrix, of any of periodic solutions, for example, this and this, as long as they correspond to the same energy level. Okay, take this energy. So you see two regions of where oscillations are possible. Down at the bottom of this well and over here. These two solutions, these two branches, we can consider and we will consider as a single solution, as the same solution. But of course, to do it, I have to introduce, instead of real independent variable, I will introduce complex independent variable. So let me write a few formulas to explain what I mean. For example, this separatrix solution, say that one that jumps to infinity, is given by, we can integrate this equation, is given by the formula 3/2 over sinh square x over 2. That will give us this solution. You see, when x is equal to 0, it becomes infinity, so we go to infinity. And of course, we don't see this branch, but in order, so when we go along the real axis, so this is x, but now I want it to be a complex plane. So as we move along the real axis over here, that means that we are moving along this trajectory. But if we decide, of course, this is an autonomous solution, and I could do any shift of independent variable. And in particular, if I want to consider another y, say x plus i pi, then in fact I will get minus 3/2 cosh square x over 2 because of simple relation between sinh and cosh. And so that means that if I shift my trajectory from being here into being here, into going along a horizontal line here with imaginary part I pi, that means that from this trajectory I'm going to that trajectory, right? And the same will be true for another solutions, for periodic solutions given by Weierstrass elliptic function. I will maybe return to this later. Okay, so that's important correspondence between different branches of solutions that correspond to the same energy. And now I would like to ask a question Okay, so what is the first immediate question we want to ask? Do homoclinic solution survive a singular perturbation? Well, the first, and now I will give some a brief historical remarks, that the first and the most straightforward and we call it now naive approach is to try to construct a solution, say x epsilon as a series to k y k of x. So keeping as y naught unperturbed solution, say this one or that one, let's try to construct the perturbation series and see what will we get. And maybe it will help us to answer the question, can there be a solution that at least for small epsilon goes to plus and minus, at plus and minus infinity goes to zero, and if we also put a restriction that we would like to consider solutions that are symmetrical in x. That is, even function with respect to point x equal, well, even functions in x. Clearly, the solutions of unperturbed equation possesses this property, this or that, right? Yes, yes. Even if it is not so, we can... What is y2? Well, so far it's clear about the unperturbed solution, but as a matter of fact, it's clear in general that if one can prove that there, for this equation, of course, that there exists a solution having zero limits at plus and minus infinity, then one can always shift the time so that it will be an even function for the perturbed equation. For equation number two. Okay, actually it will it. Oh, of course. No, I'm speaking about equation two. No, I'm not speaking about arbitrary. For the matter of convenience. Because in general you are right, there might be odd powers or fractional powers, but I will be able to satisfy with even powers. So therefore, I will show it in a second. it's convenient to introduce a variable, new variable p, based on our observation. What are our original equations that we want to deform? So let's take this p as 1 over sinh square. And for some reason that will be clear later, I prefer to deal with sinh than with cosh, with inverse sinh than with 1 over sinh that was 1 over cosh. So let's introduce this variable. Then it is, we need somehow then to differentiate, to plug it into the equation. So we need to know how the differential operator acts on the powers of this thing, and it's a simple computation to show that this is k plus 1 half p plus k squared pk. So that's the action of the d square in our variable x, of course. And now, of course, we can then substitute the series and do calculations, and the immediate result is that let's say statement 1. We can satisfy the perturbed equation. I should have given some numbers to those equations, but it's clear that I am talking about this perturbed equation, and I try to satisfy it with this series, and we can satisfy it with this perturbation series, where yk equals pk of p, where pk is a polynomial of order k plus 1. That's a simple, more or less simple computation, and one can show that successively we can satisfy equation for epsilon to the power 0, epsilon square, epsilon 4, and so forth, where those guys will be polynomial. So, well, if one wants to see it immediately, we can look at, again, at, let's see that we can satisfy, leading order equation is this, of course. Right, let's see that we can satisfy. So if we have d square minus 1, d square, just a brief demonstration, d square minus 1, well, we apply to some unknown parameter a. So I'm claiming that this is a polynomial of the first, of when k is equal 0, polynomial should be of order 1, so I claim it has this form, and so we will have 1, so we will have 1 times 3 halves, we will have 3 halves p plus, that will be 1 and minus 1, so it will be 0. So we will have this times a t equals a square p square. That is the right-hand side, which is y square, right? So from here, immediate computation gives us a equals 3 halves. And we can proceed so on and compute all those polynomials. However, what does it tell us? This observation. Well, it seems that formally we can satisfy the perturbed equation in such a way that the perturbation series consists of terms that go to infinity at plus and minus infinity at x equals plus and minus infinity goes to zero. Excuse me, at x equals plus and minus infinity, and they are all even. So, at least in the formal sense, we satisfied the equation. So now the only little question is if this perturbation series is convergent for any epsilon, even different from zero. And the answer, unfortunately, here is no, as we will see down the road. So the conclusion is that perhaps if the answer no probably indicates that we cannot have a homoclinic solution after perturbation. But it also indicates that the difference between stable manifold, or let me use it, solution that goes to zero at plus infinity and solution that goes to zero at minus infinity, the difference between them, somewhere in the middle, let's take at x equals zero, should be smaller than any power of epsilon. Otherwise, we would detect it somewhere in this power series. So, and in fact, we will see in a few minutes that it will be exponentially small. So the problem here now is that we have a power series expansion. Apparently, the same power series expansion will serve for two solutions, one coming from plus infinity and another coming from minus infinity. By coming from plus infinity, I mean it goes to zero at plus infinity, and we pull it back, and it goes to a zero at minus infinity, and we push it forward, and somewhere they meet. So the point they meet will be the point where at all powers of epsilon they coincide, but there is a difference which is smaller than any power than epsilon. So that were considerations why people termed it, people namely Martin Kraskal and those who follow him, termed it as asymptotics beyond all order, meaning beyond all order of epsilon. Now, what is the idea how we can, starting from this trivial observation, how we can do the next step, which will be a little bit non-trivial, so we'll get away of this naive perturbation approach and come to something else. So it is clear that we need some sort of a microscope to see. It's like a peeling of analogy of maybe leaves of a cabbage. You peel them. Those are powers of epsilon. You peel them. You peel them, and you see they are like symmetrical and everything, but somewhere in the core there is a difference, and we have to get to this difference. So otherwise, we need to some sort of a microscope that will allow us to see this difference. And this microscope, in this case, is so we're actually talking about this solution, right? What happens to this solution after the perturbation. So we will have another two dimensions sticking from the blackboard, and the trajectory will be now not in the two-dimensional phase space, but in the four-dimensional and so on. But still, in order to see the difference or mismatch of these two solutions, we actually need to analyze this solution and see how do they mismatch near infinity. So that will be our microscope. So, and again, if the differences between two solutions is very small, pull them to the point where those solutions become large. So maybe the difference between them will be noticeable. Okay, so how to, and that was the idea of Kraskal, and in their paper, Kraskal and Segur, but I think that the originally idea, its roots goes to Russian school, Pokrovsky and Khalatnikov, and maybe somebody else, I don't know. They suggested the following, three steps. Well, actually, three steps, this is now what we can talk about, so this was six. So first step will be rescaling. That is when we get in the vicinity of these large values of those solutions. Of course, we need to go into the complex plane. That is how we go from here, from this branch to this branch, right? So first is rescaling. And the second is new, how do I call it? Oh, I will say it, leading order analysis. Of the rescaled, people often call it inner equation. And the third point is convergence. So there are three main points. Originally, Kraskal did the first one, the second one was done numerically, and the third one was ignored, more or less. And but it was really the most challenging part is the third part. So after rescaling, we get some new equation, we consider its leading order, and that we managed to do some work with this leading order and that, and then we will have to push back to the full equation. Okay, so let me characterize those steps that as they are maybe the core of the method. So in the case of rescaling, so you see, if we consider here, this is our perturbed equation. If we consider the unperturbed equation, it doesn't contain the leading order derivative. And so far, we are lacking some information in the leading order equation. So idea is of rescaling is to pull this term into the leading order, right? And also, we don't want to lose nonlinearity. It also has to be in the leading order. So maybe, so that's, therefore, the following change of variables, x equals epsilon z and y equals z over epsilon, where epsilon is a small parameter, will lead us to a new equation, which we can write d square plus 1, d square minus epsilon square v equals v square. So that is the rescaled equation. What is the leading order of this rescaled equation? Well, we need just to drop epsilon, right? So the leading order will be fourth derivative plus second derivative equals v square. So you see, we have a new leading order equation, right? And now the advantage is that we can see the difference in the behavior at plus infinity and minus infinity already at the leading order. We wouldn't need to go into some higher orders to see that there is a break of symmetry. We'll see it immediately at the leading order. So that was the first step. The second step will be the way to analyze this equation. And the third step will be to whatever conclusions we'll get from here, we will need to pull this argument back to the full equation. So the three steps. Now, I would like to briefly discuss, okay, what can we say about about this leading order rescaled equation. What type of solutions of this equation should we be looking at? So the answer is more or less straightforward. Let's take the solution of the unperturbed equation, which is 3/2. So let's write v of z. That solution to this let me write. I'll try to write smaller. Well, it's that is sort of not a rigorous argument, but just inspirational. It will be so v should be and here sorry I forgot should be epsilon square should be epsilon square times y. Let's take unperturbed y, which is this sinh. So it will be times 3/2 times sinh square, and instead of x, I will put epsilon z over 2. Now let's take limit of epsilon goes to 0, and maybe we will get some idea what should be the leading order behavior of this equation. And if we take this limit, epsilon goes to 0, we'll get 6 over z square as epsilon goes to 0 and z is fixed. So speaking about this equation, we should probably pay some attention to the solutions that behave as 6 over z square as z goes to infinity. Right? Okay, now the question is what solutions can we find that will satisfy this equation? And of course, the most naive way is try power series if it will work. And we can try power series, and there is no accident that I put the hat here, because hat will in my annotations will indicate that something is formal. We're not sure what we are talking about in terms of convergence, but we don't care about convergence. So therefore I can say that so we will be looking for solution of this type. And here is a statement which can be proven without much difficulties, is that there exists a unique formal power series solution with even powers of z, where the first coefficient is 6 over z squared, the leading coefficient. If you fix the leading coefficient, then there is no freedom. Actually, you will get a unique power series. No. Only this. Right now we're talking about this equation. But of course there will be the question about convergence of this. But let me go step by step. So the first statement is that under the condition that we are looking for solution in the even powers, and there are all reasons to look for the solution in the even powers, because we want to talk about symmetrical solution. So if it has some behavior at infinity, it better be the same at the right end, on the right and on the left. So now the statement is that we have a unique formal power series solution once we start with constant divided by z squared. We don't have choice. Okay. Now, we're in the realm of ordinary differential equation in the complex domain. And there is a theory about such objects, especially if we're talking about local theory. Local means that we're in the vicinity of some point. In this case, we're in the vicinity of infinity, in some vicinity of infinity. And in this case, there is a theorem telling that once you have a formal power solution, no matter how complicated your equation or system of equation is, then of course, I assume that all coefficients are, whatever is the meaning of the coefficients, are analytic in some sense. then there is always an analytic solution, an analytic function that has this as asymptotic expansion in some sector of the complex plane, and that is actual solution to your equation. So in brief, once you have a formal solution, you have an actual solution in a certain direction or in a certain sector of the complex plane. Again, this is well-known result. So from here, it follows immediately that we have a solution. Let's call it V plus of Z. So if this is a Z complex plane now, so V plus has these asymptotics at plus infinity. And then we will have V minus having the same asymptotic, but when Z goes to minus infinity. Actually, not only along the real direction, but in some sector here and here. Question, are these two, in fact, the same solution, or they are different? So that's essentially the question that we need to answer. And once we find the answer to this question, we will need to know, we will need to translate this answer from this leading order equation to the full equation. Right? So, okay. So now I would like to make a statement. Excuse me? Right, in some sectors, say in this sector, for large Z, and in this sector. No. It doesn't mean at all. First of all, they are not equal. This sign means they have asymptotic behavior. That's not equal. Maybe a good example would be Bessel function. If you take a Bessel function, right, and your Hankel function on whatever, and it behaves, it has some oscillations and then some series, and you take expansion of the, you consider for the expansion for large value of Z, right? So if you remove these oscillations, so you have just formal series at plus infinity and the same formal series at minus infinity, but they will not be, that doesn't mean that the same Bessel function has, so the sector of validity of this expansion is like from minus pi to pi or something like that. It's bounded. It's not around. Okay. So the statement is that this coefficients are sign alternating. And that can be easily extracted from the equation. So series AK Z to K, the coefficients are real and sign alternating. Well, that is in general, it's a very difficult question. Given a formal series, find it if it has zero or non-zero radius of convergence. That's a very difficult question. But in this example, I managed to find that this sign alternation is sufficient to prove that the series is divergent. And the proof is very simple, and I would like to show it to you. But first, I will need some background statement that is not so simple. And it's a general, some sort of a general theorem applied to our equation. And basically, it will say that if we consider the inverse. Before formulating this theorem, I have to introduce the Laplace transform and inverse Laplace transform. Well, I don't need to introduce, everybody knows it. But what is a little bit tedious point is, what does it mean to apply, and I would like to apply inverse Laplace transform. But what does it mean to apply inverse Laplace transform to some formal object? Well, I will apply it formally to each term. And in this capacity is known as Borel transform. So Borel transform essentially is inverse Laplace transform applied formally to each series. And then there is another property of this power series. We can roughly estimate the rate of growth. And we will find that it grows not faster than factorial. Right? So the inverse Laplace transform essentially divides the coefficients by AK by K factorial. So that's how it will act, and it will take this variable into a dual variable. So if I'm not mistaken, that the inverse Laplace, or let me call it Borel transform, say applied to 1 over z to the 2k is 1 over 2k factorial, or maybe 2k minus 1. I would apologize if I made it wrong. And here some dual variable, let me call it P. It's not the same P as before, it's a different P. Well, some dual variable, right? So it is clear that after we apply Borel transform, this series will be some, this formal series will become convergent, at least for some small values of P, right? So by the way, I can apply the inverse Laplace transform to the whole equation, because if I'm applying inverse Laplace transform to a formal solution, why not to apply it to the whole equation? And if I do so, I will get the following equation. You know that each derivative comes into the minus P, so I will get t square plus 1, and let me call V capital of P the inverse Laplace transform of this series, or Borel transform of this. And here we will have, just because of the V square, we will have convolution square of P, right? Where convolution F convolution G is integral from 0 to P F of tau G P minus tau P tau. That's the definition of convolution. Okay, so what can we say about this convolution equation? So the theorem tells that the solution V of P is analytic in the complex plane, except possibly plus minus I, plus minus 2I, plus minus 3I, etc. That's a good comment. Actually, solution that we obtained by Borel transforming this series. So solution that we obtained by applying this, by dividing by factorial, essentially. Yes. Yes, and this convergent series will satisfy this equation. And there is a statement about its singularities. And moreover, it also, in any non-vertical direction, it has no more than exponential growth, so we can use direct Laplace transform. No. And again, that's a general theorem applied to this equation. Yes. There is more general theory about Givray type of series, and then if it will grow faster, I will use a little bit different transform. But I have no intention into going into that. It's just for our purposes that's enough. And now I would like to indicate how this singularity occurs. Well, if you try, for example, the first term should be, because here the first term was 6 over z squared, so here the first term for this solution will be 6p. So I can start to do iteration. I will try to solve it by iteration, substituting here 6p and then doing iterations and so on and so forth. And with each iteration, you see that we will have divide by this polynomial, the right-hand side. So the problems can be either in zero or at the point plus minus I. So we can show that there is no problem in zero, but in the point plus minus I, there might be a problem. And then there is this convolution equation has a property that it propagates singularity. So once you have singularity in I, you will have in 2I, 3I, and so forth. Okay. So again, given that this theorem, let us observe that the solution V of P has, I can write it as 6P plus A2 P cube. Well, perhaps A2 divided by, A1, A2 by 3 factorial plus A3 divided by, 3 factorial, 5 factorial. That is what we get from applying the Borel transform here. But now my observation is that if you go along the segment in the p-plane now, you go on this vertical segment, the argument of this expression stays the same. That's a complex valued function, but its argument stays the same. Actually, its argument will be pi over 2 all the time. Because, see, that term is I, right? Multiple to I. That should be I cubed, which is minus I, but this has different sign. So it's again proportional to I. And so is this, and so is, so they all have the same argument. So let's think for simplicity that they are positive, because we can factor out this argument. Then this, in this convolution, we will have positive value here. Times some argument. Right? But just, Andrei, let me finish the logic, and then I will be happy to answer. So if we choose now P equals exactly I, so suppose, now I would like to say, suppose that this function has no singularity at plus minus I, right? Then the left, if this has no singularity, we plug here I, we get zero in the left-hand side. But in the right-hand side, we cannot have zero, because here is the integral. Here these factors are different from zero, and they both are positive. So integral here should have some positive value. So we got a contradiction, and the contradiction comes from our assumption that there is no singularity at I. So there should be singularity at I. What's your question? Well, it's not positive. It's if you factor I, then it will be positive, right? Because we are going along this direction in the complex p-plane, right? So this is I, this is minus I term, I cubed is minus I, and then so on. You divide by 1 factorial or something like that. Maybe I apologize if I confuse. Maybe it's 2k minus 1. Perhaps you're right. I apologize when I wrote this, and I'm ready to apologize as many times as necessary for that. Okay, so the bottom line that we showed that there is a singularity, right, in the solution in the Borel plane, and now the simple argument tells us that the series should be divergent. Why is that? Imagine that the series is convergent, right, with even small radius of convergence. Well, very large towards infinity. Then we can measureize by some geometric series. But if we divide geometric series by factorials, we will get something that will converge everywhere. So then this equation would not be able to have singularity, but it has. So the end of the argument. So what did we achieve right now? Right now we know that if we are looking for solution that behave, for solution of this equation, that behaves like, now I'm talking about actual solution, analytic solution, that behaves like 6 over z towards infinity, say when z goes to plus infinity, then we know that if I take this solution and try to continue it analytically, I cannot continue it all the way up to the negative, direction. Because if I would be able, that will mean that it is a convergent series, which we for sure know it's not. Okay, because there is the following statement. If you have an analytic function, let's put it differently. If you have a function that has a univalued function that has the same analytic expansion in the whole vicinity of a singular point, say infinity, formal expansion as a formal series, then this formal series should be convergent. There is a statement like that. This follows from complex analysis. Okay, so now I can say that. So here is the. Let me draw another picture, and I really didn't want to spend that much time over here. So here are the singular points. So this is the p-plane, and now I can. Very well, I know solution of this convolution equation with capital of P here. I would rather like to go back to the original equation. And in order to do so, all I need to do is to take the direct Laplace transform. So I will write that v plus of z is integral from 0 to infinity e minus pz v of p dt, and that gives me solution. We know properties of Laplace transform, that this solution is analytic in the right half plane, not of p, but of z complex plane, and has asymptotic expansion exactly given by this series. And of course, I can do the same thing in the negative direction, but I will need to integrate over here, and then I will get v minus pz v of p dt, and that will give another solution that is analytic in the negative half plane and has the same asymptotic expansion. And now I know that clearly these two solutions cannot be the same. So what is the difference between them? Well, in order to compute the difference, I have to subtract one from another. So that means that I have to consider this integral if I want to subtract one from another. Or, for example, if I want, I can integrate it. I can change the contour of integration and integrate this way. So roughly speaking, and that can be proven, the first contribution comes from this singularity over here. And based on this analysis before, when I said that, well, this is positive and that should be zero, so it cannot match, we can derive, and there are other arguments, how we can derive that the behavior of V of P minus I, so really we now need some information about this point. And the information as follows, is it behaves near the point I as some constant. Times some constant over p minus I plus some higher order terms. So this constant is a very important constant. It's known as a Stokes constant. It's not exactly the residue, because the residue means that there is no branching at this point, and it is. It has logarithmic term, and it can have some branching, but the leading order term is like a constant, in this case, over p minus I. Well, for other equations, it can be different. But in this case, that is it. So now we can, if we now plug this into this difference between these two integrals, we will see that and I am running out a little bit of blackboard. But then it will cover that one. So, okay. So then we will see that the difference v plus minus v minus behaves like this constant times integral e to the minus zp over p minus I, so that will be, if I didn't make a mistake, c e minus I z, and somewhere I have to either multiply it by 2 pi I or divide or something like that. Does it make sense? Yes. So you see that means that we get an exponentially small term, because in it looks like oscillatory if z is real, but z is not real. Right, because as I said somewhere before, perhaps here, that we are along this actually we are not along this line, we are along this line over epsilon, so we are far away, and therefore this exponentially small, so our z should be taken from here. So therefore we get exponentially small term like one over epsilon, minus one over epsilon x. So that is how we can show that we expect exponentially small difference between these two solutions. However, this is far from being proof. That is a proof only that the argument is rigorous only working with this equation. But still there is this equation. And that was the major obstacle in this, because that was known for some time, to me at least, during past 10 or 12 years or something like that. But transition from here to here was a big step. And that was, for this equation, I've done the proof 4 years ago or something like that. And I would like to give, of course, no mentioning of the proof, but at least some formulation. Actually, there, I don't think I have time even for formulation. So, usually people give sketch of the proof. I will give sketch of the statement in this case. So the idea is that if we are considering full solution to the full equation, that goes to zero at plus infinity, then I can prove that it approaches v plus of z given by this expression as epsilon goes to zero uniformly in the follow region of the z plane. So here is I pi over 2, and so this is a z plane and this is zero. So this is a region, and here is some quantity r, which is a large number, as large as necessary, but still it will be within the strip, because in the limit epsilon goes to zero, I pi over epsilon goes very, very high, so it always there. So in this strip, convergence is uniform. Now, of course, I have to a little subtlety here, that the equation is that the stable solutions that go to plus at zero at plus infinity, it's a one parameter family. So I have to specify which solutions I can. R depends on equation, basically. No, it's independent. Yeah, something like that. But it will, you can change it going from equation to equation. You can consider another equation. Yeah, it's like million or 10 millions or whatever. Okay, so that actually closes the argument about existence of a homoclinic solution. Because I can argue that if there would be a homoclinic solution, say, y of z epsilon that goes, let me translate everything into the term of inner equation, v of z epsilon. Then, and then that means that if I take z, real part of z positive, and take the limit, it should approach solution z plus. But if I take the same solution and take real part of z negative, and take the limit epsilon goes to zero, it should approach z minus. But these two are different, at least over here. On this segment. So the same function cannot have two different limits as epsilon goes to zero. So therefore, the homoclinic solution doesn't exist in this case. Okay. Now I have really a few minutes, and essentially I wanted to talk about perturbations of the periodic solutions, because there are solutions inside this loop, and they can also be treated the same way. And the result will be that there can be no, at least that is something that I haven't published, but it, the result is that there can be no periodic and at the same time symmetrical solutions that can survive this perturbation. Of course, here again there is subtlety, because when you perturb equation, the energy it's natural to allow the energy also to perturb. So the energy shouldn't grow too fast with epsilon. So there was the original energy. That means I picked one loop. That means I picked energy. And then as I do perturbation, I allow this energy to vary a little bit, but in a slow fashion. Then the statement will be true. Now, however, there is this other example. Where is it? Of this solution. Now, what happens if I, instead of this equation, will consider that family? What is the interest of that family? There was a number of papers of various authors, but I think Alan Chapness is one of them that shows up in every paper, where numerically this type of equation was studied, where nu is an arbitrary real parameter. So let's consider this situation. And it has some physical importance that I will not talk about. One of the reasons I don't know it, that I wouldn't talk about. But essentially, what does it change if we consider, instead of one particular equation, the family? If we consider the family, that means, again, this in all this argument, the main player was this constant. Because if by chance this constant is zero, then we may have a homoclinic solution. So if I consider a family of equations, then this constant will depend on this parameter nu. And from the argument that I gave you so far, it follows that C of nu is non-zero is a necessary condition. C of nu is non-zero implies that there is no homoclinic solution. I cannot prove the opposite, that if it is zero, it guarantees that there is a homoclinic solution. But at least if it is not zero, then for sure there cannot be a homoclinic solution. And therefore, there is the problem of studying how the C depends on nu. Unfortunately, C, this Stokes constant, is a transcendental quantity. There is no way it can be computed in any, through any rational operation. Transcendental, I mean, you should take some limit somewhere. But what is known, that C of, if you consider this C, this constant, this singularity over here, as a function of nu, it is an entire function of parameter nu. And in recent, well, it's not work, but ongoing study with Dmitry Pilinovsky, we actually did numerical simulations and computed those values of C of nu for different nus. And the way it looks, so this is the approximate, this approximately what we get if this is mu and this is C of mu. Nu. That's what we got approximately. Actually, this value is 5/4, and that I feel a little time pressure, but I can withstand it for a while. I don't know about you. Well, this so again, this is a numerical picture, and we were interested how far can we go in justifying or proving things out here. By the way, in the papers of Chapnis, he observed this sequence which he called embedded eigenvalues of this nonlinear equation. Again, equation is here, and the corresponding and according to his numerical simulation, to each eigenvalue, there is a corresponding profile of the homoclinic solution. And for this case, it was, so as you go up the road, you will have one hump soliton, then in this case you will have two hump soliton, in this case you will have a three hump soliton, and so on. That was his numerical observations. Of course, in our case, the question is, what we would like to see is, I would just pose questions, and that will be the end of this presentation. So first question, if C is zero, means there is a homoclinic solution. That's the first question. Can we prove the opposite way? If the Stokes constant is zero, does it mean that there is a solution? By the way, this solution is called embedded solitons in jargon, in literature. Well, second question, if one is true, what is the expression? And the third question, how to show infinitely many embedded eigenvalues. We did some work in all these directions, but of course time frame is too short to give any details. But essentially that is a project that we are thinking about. Thank you very much.